Welcome to episode 15 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. Thank you for joining us. Today's lineup includes Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things. He's now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Michael Vadas is not with us. He is touring the Johnstown Flood Museum with a minivan and two children. In his place, we have guest commentator Maury Schenck. Maury has worked with me for probably 20 years. Isn't that right, Maury?
Just about.
Yeah. Doing a variety of law enforcement, cryptography, and export control issues. He finally moved to London, where he continues to be associated with the Steptoe London office, and he's maintained his interest in criminal and law enforcement regulation of technology and telecom. Our guest commentator today is Dan Sutherland, the Associate General Counsel and top legal advisor to the part of DHS that worries about cybersecurity, telecom, critical infrastructure, and biometrics. That is also known as NPPD. We'll be talking to him about DHS's role in dealing with the private sector now that NIST has released its cybersecurity framework and a whole host of other issues. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks.
And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and record holder for returning to Steptoe & Johnson to practice law more times than any other lawyer. Okay, why don't we get started with this week in NSA news. There's some little things going on. The FBI and the ACLU are fighting over a FOIA request that the ACLU made for information about the 215 program. There have been a number of disclosures driven in part by Snowden. The FBI and the administration have refused to turn over everything, so the ACLU continues its lawsuit, the FBI has asked for summary judgment. So that case may produce a result sometime in the next several months. Larry Klayman, this is a big surprise, has lost another legal fight. He tried to go straight to the Supreme Court from his success in the district court challenging 215. That's the only decision declaring that 215, the metadata program of the National Security Agency, is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Klayman wanted to skip the Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court said, no, go back and do this the way everybody else does. The most interesting issue, and the one that I thought might be worth discussing, is that Bloomberg has written, I guess, a story and a half claiming that the Heartbleed exploit was actually used by NSA. Heartbleed is the first serious flaw to have not only a cool name but its own logo. It is a flaw in OpenSSL, which allowed anyone to go to a secure server and say, "Hi, I'd like you to here's my password. It's cat. Please send me back the word cat and whatever 64,000 bytes of data you might have sitting around in memory." And apparently, because of the way the OpenSSL update was written 2 years ago, all of that data, sort of a random scoop of 64K bytes, was sent back to the person who made the request. It left no trace. There's no way to know for sure what data might have been scooped up and how long this has been exploited, although I think the latest news For a while, everybody's hair was on fire on this one. There was a suggestion that, oh my God, it's, I think Bruce Schneier said on a scale of 1 to 10, it's an 11. We're getting less worried about it. It's still a bad thing. It needs to be patched very quickly, because it is, potentially does disclose people's passwords if they're logging on at the same time that the data is being scooped up. There are exploits in the wild, but no one's found an exploit in the wild that existed before, the disclosure of the bug, except that Bloomberg, prepared issued a story on Friday saying NSA was exploiting it and claiming to have two anonymous sources who were familiar with the matter. Remarkably, and I have to say I'm kind of proud of them, the National Security Agency within 12 hours, maybe 8 hours of the story coming out, issued a categorical denial saying, nope, not true. Director of National Intelligence did the same. And frankly, I think the story is looking a little shaky. The guy who wrote that has another story out saying, oh, what I really want to talk about is all of these exploits that the government has stored and, you know, how they're regulating when they're used and when they're disclosed to people. He does say that his sources stand by their claim, but there's a little bit of backing and filling where people say, well, they could exploit SSL. It's not exactly the same as the Heartbleed vulnerability, but there's something that the NSA can do about SSL. But that really is quite different from saying that a vulnerability that everybody thought originally was an 11 on a 10-point scale was used comfortably by the National Security Agency for 2 years without telling anybody. And so I have to say, I think the story is probably wrong as originally written. But it did, cause the president, or at least the White House, to disclose a new policy, one that they say has existed for a few weeks, but which was only made public as a result of this story, saying that the president had adopted the expert group recommendation that serious vulnerabilities be disclosed rather than saved for exploitation. It's a pretty general policy, as you'd expect, since you can't really put the entire cyber espionage and cyber attack capabilities of the U.S. At risk by disclosing everything. It does raise this question, which is, can you get a Pulitzer for a story that drives policy changes even though the story was false? I'm guessing you can, because as long as it's only the National Security Agency that's harmed by the scoop or the false statement, nobody cares other than a few people who work there.
Well, you know, speaking of stories that aren't going to get Pulitzers, what surprised me about this is the number of stories, even before the NSA issued a statement, that just simply speculated that the NSA was probably behind it or utilizing it. You know, stories that openly described the bug and then mentioned the fact that NSA had a documented interest in going after SSL encryption, and just put two and two together and got 22.
I think that the Snowden documents and the way the Snowden documents are being used increasingly in a kind of, trust me, I looked at the documents and this is true, without any further information, especially coming from people who have a vested interest in saying, you know, that the National Security Agency is pure evil, has made it easier for other people just to write those stories. They did check this story with NSA and got a no comment the first time around, but within a few hours they had gotten something much more conclusive, and yet they ran the story. And my guess is that they've got some contractor who said, well, I helped them crack SSL, on reflection, maybe it wasn't this bug, maybe it was some other rather less frightening attack, but it almost doesn't matter now to the press. So you can just say anything you like about NSA. Well, speaking of people you can say anything you like about, Wyndham Resorts is just going from loss to loss. We kind of expected this, but the district court has now ruled, right?
Yes. In fact, during our episode last week, Michael was talking about the LabMD case, and he mentioned that the Wyndham decision was due any time now, and it came out later that day.
Yeah, and he sort of expected this exact result.
Exactly. And this was not unexpectedly a big victory for the FTC and a validation of sorts of their efforts to bring enforcement actions against companies for allegedly failing to adopt reasonable cybersecurity standards. People who followed the case know that on three separate occasions between 2008 and 2010, attackers got into Wyndham's network and compromised potentially hundreds of thousands of customers' payment card data, which was sent to an internet address in Russia. Wyndham had been the poster child for the growing frustration that a lot of companies in the U.S. feel about the blame the victim attitude that courts and some in the regulatory sphere take over data breaches. And Wyndham argued that the FTC's attempt to hold companies responsible for failing to adopt reasonable security standards in the absence of any regulations defining reasonable was unfair. And Judge Esther Salas in New Jersey disagreed. She found that the FTC did have the authority to regulate data security practices under the Section 5 of the FTC Act, which governs unfair and deceptive trade practices. And she said that the FTC did not have to formally issue regulations in advance defining what's reasonable or adequate in order to do that. Now, Wyndham had actually argued that the FTC lacked authority because Congress has enacted sector-specific data security laws in the financial sector when it comes to children, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, HIPAA, and cited all those statutes as an indication that Congress did not intend for the FTC to have this general authority. And the judge rejected that and found that those sector-specific pieces of legislation complement rather than preclude the FTC having this authority. And she rejected the notion of fair notice. In fact, she seemed to adopt wholesale the FTC's position that it's repeatedly stated that companies just have to look at their prior actions and their prior complaints and their prior consent decrees and their own public statements to be on notice of what the FTC considered reasonable or not. So now the case proceeds on the merits.
I thought I saw something in that decision that suggested that the basic standard is if it harms consumers, then it obviously was unfair. So if you do not protect them against the most obscure attacks, for example, Heartbleed, everybody who was subject to the Heartbleed vulnerability is now in violation of the FTC rules because it could harm consumers.
Well, or at least the FTC's got the authority to bring an action if that's the case. So, you know, in terms of the impact of the ruling, this is simply confirmed what the FTC has been asserting loudly all along, that it has very broad authority under Section 5 to go after companies for their cybersecurity practices. And I think it's not like the FTC was being timid in the absence of a ruling like this, but I think they're only going to be more aggressive after this, even in the absence of legislation or regulations or other standards defining what reasonable is.
So a goes from here to trial, or at least to summary judgment.
Right? Yeah. Or at least there'll be some determination on the merits. This was just really about the FTC's authority to go forward. Now the court's got to decide whether in fact Wyndham was reasonable.
Well, and fresh from that victory, they've also told WhatsApp and Facebook that they've got some. I don't know what to call what they said. Is it was just a warning shot across the bow?
That's how I took it. You know, it was sort of extraordinary, and it seems to reflect some suspicion of Facebook based on prior consent decree with Facebook. But Jessica Rich, who's the head of the Bureau of Consumer Protection, sent a letter to the chief privacy officer of Facebook and the general counsel of WhatsApp, reminding them of their obligations to protect users' privacy in the wake of the acquisition of WhatsApp that's in the works. And the letter was at times, almost patronizing in reminding them of their obligations. The letter observed that WhatsApp's privacy policies are more restrictive than Facebook's. WhatsApp says that it collects and maintains and uses a much more limited set of data than Facebook does. And that the officials from both companies have told said publicly that WhatsApp's privacy practices are not going to change once they're acquired by Facebook. And Ms. Rich said that the failure to honor those promises may result in a Section 5 investigation. It also may violate the 2011 consent decree with Facebook, which required the company to get affirmative consent before it makes any material changes.
Mean, do you think that means they can never change WhatsApp's policies? That can't be right.
You know, it's interesting and it's ambiguous in the way the letter reads. I mean, there's a warning that issued in the letter that they need to get affirmative express consent before they use data in a manner that's materially different from the promises they made in the past. And they recommend giving users the right to opt out if they're going to change their policies for how they collect data in the future. So it suggests that as long as they go out of the way to get express consent to making a change for data they previously collected, they'd be okay. But any consent mechanism they come up with is going to be scrutinized clearly, you know, very closely.
So essentially, Rich is flipping the presumption and saying, you have to get affirmative consent as opposed to you have to get an opt out rather than or an opt-in. No, you have to force people to opt in rather than telling them we're changing our policies unless you opt out.
Right. And some of that may be a function of the fact that the FTC has this consent decree with Facebook that requires them to get express consent. But it's extraordinary. It's putting them on notice now that if they do anything that the FTC is watching very closely.
Yep. And I thought I'd give you one opportunity to say something nice about the FTC, because they did come down hard on a company that, you know, talk about truth in advertising, calls itself jerk.com, and really sounds like they deserve their URL.
Yeah, I have to say, this is a family show, so I'll just say that jerk.com is an understatement. So this is a website advertised to people that there were profiles on their website labeling people as either jerk or not a jerk, two very broad categories. And they told consumers that they could revise their profiles. Presumably they would want to revise them from jerk to not a jerk. I don't know why you'd want to go the other way, for a small fee of $30. And what they in fact did was they harvested personal information from Facebook and created the profiles themselves. And then marketed their service to people to get their profiles changed. And according to the FTC, between 2009 and 2013, the operators of the site created 73 million jerk.com profiles, including for children, and included comment fields where people could enter comments about you that in many cases were, you know, worse than what you'd hear on the, what I certainly used to hear on the playground in middle school. They also included photos that were harvested from Facebook despite being designated as private. And the FTC alleged that the defendants, besides being jerks, violated the FTC Act in a number of ways. First, they misrepresented that the profiles had been created by other jerk.com users when, in fact, it was created by the jerks who ran the website. And second, they falsely stated that by paying for this $30 premium membership, they could get their profiles changed. And in fact, that was often not the case. And they even charged $25 just to email the customer service department on top of the $30 for the premium subscription. So the FTC is seeking an order barring these jerks from engaging in deceptive practices and directing them to delete the data. And the next step will be a hearing before an administrative law judge in January. So, as you said, we have to give credit where credit is due because we're not often complimentary to the FTC, but they certainly deserve it here.
Yeah, their request for unlimited prosecutorial discretion sort of actually looks plausible in this case, at least. Probably the biggest news internationally of the week is the European Court of Justice striking down what had been the most aggressive governmental response, the most intrusive and anti-privacy governmental response to 9/11. And those who follow the podcast will not be surprised that I say that about a European measure, because I'm always glad to point out European hypocrisy. The Europeans adopted a data retention directive in the wake of 9/11, requiring providers of telecom and internet services to keep data for 6 to 24 months. And all of the countries, or practically all of the countries, have now adopted legislation to put that directive into effect. But a couple of them have litigated into the European Court of Justice, which issued a sweeping decision declaring the directive invalid, lacking in proportionality, and the like. And so I'm going to ask Maury to give us a little bit more background on that.
Well, you say it was a response to 9/11. You know, there were some follow-up smaller attacks in London and Madrid that shocked people in Europe, and it was after the Madrid attacks in 2006 that the data retention directive was adopted. So it was the same kind of smaller European experience. It was, as you say, anti-privacy. It was the data retention directive creates an explicit exception to European privacy and data protection law that says to every European member state, you must adopt a law that requires your carriers to retain subscriber data on subscriber communications for a period of 6 to 24 months, and individual member states get to choose. And since the beginning, various people have said, well, this is inconsistent with fundamental principles of privacy law. And this past Tuesday, the European Court of Justice agreed. They said some form of data retention is proper for law enforcement purposes, for investigation of serious crimes, but the data retention directive is too broad brush, and therefore it, quote, is invalid, unquote, as a whole. However, this still leaves all these individual pieces of member state legislation that have been adopted in force. They don't need the data retention directive to exist, and in fact there were some before the directive was adopted. And now carriers are in a pretty tough position, you know, to decide, do we follow these member laws that are still in force that might be invalid under the same reasoning but have not yet been found that? And if they are narrow enough, if they, you know, meet the strictures that the European Court of Justice has set out, then they might turn out to be valid. And, you know, we're seeing different responses in different countries on this already.
So is it your assumption that these laws will ultimately have to pass muster under the kind of scattershot set of rulings from the European Court of Justice? I wouldn't describe their opinion as a model of clarity and clear thought. Some of the stuff they just seem to have tossed in to say, oh, yeah, it's invalid for that reason, too.
Yeah, I think it's unclear exactly how it will play out, but yes, it will need to pass muster on a country-by-country basis against some set of standards like those set out by the European Court of Justice. You know, one could imagine future European Court of Justice rulings, although it takes a while. Some countries are saying, we're definitely going to keep data retention in progress. We think our country's law, you know, passes muster under this standard. Some countries, Sweden, the communications regulator has already said, well, you know, the European Court of Justice has spoken. Our law might still be on the books, but we're not going to pursue enforcement against any carrier that stops retaining. And so I've gotten some advice from Swedish counsel that say, in those circumstances in Sweden, you should probably stop retaining. And that was a country that resisted implementing the directive for a long time. These are a couple of examples, but we, over the coming months, years, are going to see this play out on a country-by-country basis.
And does it go back to the Court of Justice, or is this the European Court of Human Rights that will hear these appeals?
Well, so the European Court of Human Rights could hear the appeals if people file. So what happened in these cases is this was the European Court of Justice decision was a consolidated referral from Ireland and Germany, where there were some challenges to the data retention directive, and it was referred for a view by the ECJ of whether the directive complies with European law. It is possible that countries that don't follow that decision could be viewed as violating privacy law, and that it could end up in the European Court of Human Rights. Overall, it's a very fluid judicial and legislative situation that won't be clear for a long time, although, you know, the consensus seems to be that some form of data retention is here to stay. You know, you've said that on this podcast before, Stuart, that it's unlikely that the U.S. is going to fully get rid of the NSA's program for retaining some data on communications.
Right.
And the sense is the same in Europe.
That's interesting. So that one of the things the ECJ said was, well, this is obviously lacking in proportionality because you don't even require that the data be stored in Europe. And they say, well, that, which is just a fundamental principle of something or other. Have you looked more closely at what that would mean? Because that strikes me as sort of leading to the whole balkanized internet that people have been worried about for a while, coming out of left field rather than out of the NSA debate.
Well, you know, we've been advising on this since 2006 when the directive passed, and we've thought that probably retention in Europe was arguably required to comply with data protection law anyhow. And so the clients we've worked with, we've said, well, to be safe, you should retain in Europe. So in terms of balkanization, there have been a few countries, Greece is one, where they've said, you don't just need to retain in Europe, you need to retain in Greece. And that, there's pretty strong European law arguments against that. That would lead to really significant balkanization. But I think it is likely that there will be an ultimate position that data retention for European subscribers does need to happen within the EU.
Well, that'll be interesting. So the Europeans will have to defend that against WTO complaints by saying that restrictions on cross-border transfer of law enforcement data are part of their national security or law enforcement requirements, which I think they probably can win that argument.
Yeah, I mean, that I would characterize as a creative argument. I mean, I think all kinds will be tried. There's usually relevant national security and law enforcement exceptions to things like WTO obligations for that kind of thing. And that's the kind of exception that people have been relying on as an exception from privacy law. The ECJ has said it doesn't fly as a blanket matter in Europe.
Well, very interesting. Moving on, I thought it would be useful to kind of continue our advanced class in class action litigation over privacy issues by following the latest in the Target litigation, which is going to touch every base in class action litigation, it looks like.
Yeah, it does. And actually, just this past week, the U.S. Judicial Panel on Multidistrict Litigation decided to consolidate the consumer class actions related to Target's breach in federal court in Minnesota. There are now over 100 consumer class actions. There are at least 25 actions, including 4 shareholder derivative suits already pending in Minnesota, so the others will join them there. That actually was Target's preference. The company's headquartered there, and a lot of the evidence will be there. Lawyers for the plaintiffs had argued for a number of other districts, including Colorado and Northern Illinois and various districts in Louisiana and California. Although
they couldn't find a way to take it to the Eastern District of Texas.
That's probably right. Although some of the financial institution plaintiffs will actually be advantaged to bring the case in Minnesota because there's state law there that allows banks to go after retailers to recover the cost of reissuing credit cards, from situations like this.
So that's what the big dollar value in this litigation is.
That's right. I mean, look, for the consumer class actions, we all know that the only people who are getting rich or getting reimbursed or getting significant compensation, I should say, are the lawyers, not the consumers. Whereas the banks have real money at stake and I think are pursuing their remedies aggressively. There are two other sort of related, data breach related, stories that I think are just worth mentioning for a second. One Target related, one not. There were news reports last week that law enforcement, which initially suspected that the Neiman Marcus hack and Target hack were done by the same group, now think that they were done by different groups of hackers, and that the Neiman Marcus hack is attributable to a group of Russian hackers that we first indicted when I was at DOJ and that were most recently charged again in New Jersey. This is the same group, some of whose members did the Heartland Payment Systems hack, which prior to Target was the biggest data breach in U.S. history. They also hacked Citigroup and JetBlue and Visa and something close to 100 other companies. You know, it's not the same group of people, but, you know, members come and go, but the core of that group is responsible for over 100 hacks of U.S. companies. There are reports that the investigators identified at least 5 other corporate victims when they looked at servers that the target attackers use as hot points. So the people who did the target hack did at least five others that we don't know about yet. But Neiman Marcus was done by this other group, which is an incredibly sophisticated group of hackers. I also wanted to just highlight a great story that Nicole Perlroth had in the New York Times last week about a watering hole attack against a large oil company that was achieved when the hackers put malware into the online delivery menu of a Chinese restaurant that a lot of the employees of the company tended to order from regularity.
Talk about takeout.
Exactly. And I bring it up only because it's a stark illustration of the challenges that companies face in securing their networks and the ingenuity and creativity of really determined attackers who want to get in. And it highlights why this blame the victim approach that we take in this country is so unfair and unwarranted. I mean, it's one thing to tell companies they have to be diligent about third parties with access to their systems. We've talked before about the HVA system for Target, vending machine, software, video conferencing equipment, printers, all kinds of third party vendors and suppliers who have access to your system. And we've talked before about how important it is to make sure that they don't have access to anything sensitive. But it's impossible to imagine that anyone could anticipate this kind of attack. And sometimes, no matter how vigilant you are about third parties, it's just not enough.
That is clearly the way attacks are going to go. There are some people for whom security is important and highly prized and worth investing in. And then there are people who are just on the web because it's slightly more convenient to put their menus up there. And for them, $10 spent on security is a little more than it's really worth. So if you can compromise them and use them to go after somebody who's more serious about security, it means that the weakest link attacks are always going to work. Although I guess I should ask you, is it true that an hour after one of these attacks, you have to go back and forth?
Yeah. You know, I always thought that that's a better line than the one I was going to use. I always thought the fact that Google provided free food to their employees was just a convenience, but who knew it was also a security measure.
Exactly. Good. Okay, so speaking of security and Groundhog Day, it's deja vu all over again. The Justice Department, the FTC, have said that antitrust law shouldn't prevent companies from getting together to share cybersecurity data most of the time. And I thought that that statement was both not that different from something they'd said 14 years ago, and not really all that comforting, because we always knew that if it was legitimate, it was legitimate, and if it was bad, it was bad. And that's pretty much what the FTC and the Justice Department said, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of like cicadas, because they come back with statements like this every 14 years. So when I was at the department, back in 2011, 2012, we were working on the administration's legislative proposal, which didn't get adopted, which is why we have the NIST framework. One of the issues that came up with some frequency was whether information sharing among private companies would implicate antitrust concerns. And most of us thought that that was much ado about nothing. And that's essentially what DOJ and the FTC said last week, although, as you said, they said it in a way that was helpful and not helpful at the same time. I mean, the policy statement was intended to reassure companies that appropriate sharing of cybersecurity and cyber attack information would not result in some sort of antitrust enforcement action. It doesn't really tell you what is or is not proper sharing, except that they said that sharing competitively sensitive information, like information about your current or future prices or output or business plans, that kind of information would not be considered part of legitimate cybersecurity information sharing. But as long as it was, technical data that was strictly speaking about cyber threats, it wouldn't be of concern to regulators. And as you said, that this is not different from something they said 14 years ago. Back in 2000, the department issued a letter at the request of the Electric Power Research Institute that gave a very similar message. So I'm not sure why they took so long to reiterate a policy that hasn't changed substantively since 2000, given that it's been known to be a concern for a couple of years. And if they were going to change it, they presumably could have been more helpful in defining what is and is not, appropriate sharing.
Dan, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this. Have you encountered lawyers telling you, "I'm worried about antitrust liability before if I join information sharing"? And I'll put a tweak on that.
lawyers who said that to you where you actually believed that that was the reason they weren't sharing the information, because there's plenty of people who say that because they have no other reason to share the information. This is the best excuse they can come up with. But I wondered whether this is a live issue in information sharing for DHS.
Well, we think about information sharing a lot. Why doesn't information pass? And there are a dozen different reasons that are given, and antitrust is one that occasionally comes up without specificity. You can't get your arms around it. It's a bit like Jell-O. The neat thing about, I think, this guidance that came out was it does allow us to really say that's not really a productive conversation. That's a bit put to bed now. Let's really talk about why you're not sharing information. It's proprietary reasons. It's or some other legal issue that we could work on or whatever. But that really is not a core issue. It's dancing around. And let's not discuss that anymore. Let's get to really where we need to be.
Any idea why this came out now? Is this something that's been on the interagency agenda for a while?
Well, I think, again, it's an issue that's been that people talk about. And it's hard to get your arms around it. So I think it's just in response to that. I think, another good thing about this is you're referencing it hasn't changed over 14 years, but they haven't made a statement in 14 years. Now they've made a statement
again. They got the FTC to join it, right?
And they got the FTC to join it, which is a significant thing.
Yeah.
And so I think maybe it didn't break new ground, but just reiterating the statement is significant. They're also, I mean, you both know trying to work on these kind of interagency statements is not easy. And as lawyers, we know it's hard to give a legal opinion without a specific fact pattern sitting in front of you. So the 2000 letter had a specific fact pattern. This is general guidance. So I think they're to be commended for sorting this through and getting it out and laying out the general.
I'm surprised there could be an interagency process. This is the sort of thing that the antitrust division gets kind of shirty about. Sort of, this is our job, and the FTC isn't even part of the interagency process. So if they let you see this 24 hours before it was public, you're ahead of where we were in previous administrations.
Oh, so in fairness, I participated in interagency processes that felt like they were taking 14 years. So it is an accomplishment to get a statement out at all.
Okay, just about the last topic I wanted to just cover was the slow recovery of international diplomatic efforts from the Snowden disaster. There have been a couple of stories in the last week or two about U.S. government international cyber diplomacy. DOD went to the Chinese and said, in the interest of reassuring you that we're not going to launch the equivalent of a nuclear attack in cyberspace, here's how we think about cyber attacks. Here's what our budget is. Here's who we have working on them. In the hope and expectation that the Chinese would reciprocate. Apparently the Chinese said, oh, thank you, do tell, and then moved on to other topics, which is exactly what I would have predicted as well. So hopefully they didn't tell them too much. And then maybe more interestingly, the U.S. has been struggling with attacks on the financial sector coming from Iran for the last two or three years. And they were very unusual attacks because they were scheduled. You know, banks were on a rotation schedule. It was only Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, if I remember right, for two or three hours, just to show what the Iranians could do. And the U.S. was struggling with it because it actually was taking banks down. The story in the Washington Post lays out the process by which the administration struggled with what to do. There were a lot of people at DOD who said, well,
these are just denial of service attacks from the compromised the machines on the internet. We can go to those compromised machines and give them a signal that will cause them to delete the malware, or at least cause the malware no longer to function, to allow the attackers to continue to use those computers. To my surprise, the administration said, oh dear, and wrung its hands over whether that was an invasion of the sovereignty of Iran or a country where the server happened to be located. So instead they went around the barn and went to 100 countries and asked them all to try to intercept or patch, intercept the denial of service packets, or patch the machines inside their territory. And the result of that was to at least diminish the effectiveness of the attacks, although it seems pretty clear that Iran has, for its own reasons, stopped doing this, or at least cut it way back in the interest of furthering the nuclear talks and the lifting of sanctions. But it does suggest that the State Department is playing a pretty big role, and that many of the debates that we've had over how do you prevent nuclear war, exactly what are you allowed to do, the development of norms for what's appropriate, is all being driven to a substantial degree by the State Department and some of these visions of international law and norms that we've seen developed over the last few years. Maury, I know you've watched, you've had a different perspective on this coming from Europe. How does this diplomacy look from across the Atlantic?
I think it's no surprise. I mean, one of the things that I think is most interesting about the whole Snowden affair is the massive disconnect between public reporting and the sort of realpolitik of what continues to go on among law enforcement authorities. And here we're talking about military authorities as well, who are concerned about cyber war. You know, I look at China a lot, and the Chinese have no incentive to stop hacking. Everybody knows they're going to keep hacking. So I'm sure what DOD is thinking is, how do we prevent this from escalating? And escalation is a real risk. You know, we see what's happening in Russia. The same thing could happen in cyber. From a more narrow European perspective, you know, rather than reacting in shock and horror to Snowden, European law enforcement authorities, my sense of the reaction is, well, yeah, we knew this was happening. We want to make sure maybe we get a little bit more authority. We didn't know quite how much was happening. And maybe we're losing some data feeds from the U.S. as a result of the controversy. So that's all the more reason to have more surveillance authority. So I'm not surprised, and I see it as just a practical accommodation to a complex security situation.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think you're right. There's a disconnect there, and actually probably the biggest losers as a result of the measures that high-tech companies have taken in response to the Snowden flap, the biggest losers are probably European and non-U.S. law enforcement, who used to be able to get access to a lot of this stuff just by tapping the connection of their targets. They could get their Gmail and Yahoo Mail, and now they've got to go hat in hand to the Justice Department to ask for access to that information through the servers and through legal process with the company. So it is a complicated problem. I do think, you know, whatever European law enforcement is saying privately, they're not toning down the criticisms from places like the European Union, or really even the leadership of Germany, who they may not be surprised that the Chinese are doing it, but they're determined to express surprise that the U.S. was doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would add to the list of losers, the U.S. companies who are cutting off these flows, because, you know, there have been arguments for a long time in Europe by European companies saying, well, don't give business to U.S. companies because your data is not secure. And that's starting to bite a little bit more than it was. So these two things play off against each other. And absolutely, there's a difference of voices within Europe. There is political criticism for various reasons of what the U.S. is doing, what's been exposed by Snowden, at the same time as law enforcement is sending a very different message. And it's a complicated situation.
Dan, it was DHS that had to log the jet miles trying to get 100 countries to agree to do something about Iran, according to the story. Did you have any perspective on the difficulties of doing that without disclosing anything that you shouldn't disclose?
No.
Yeah. Best line of the podcast, absolutely. All right. Let's actually see if we can't find some questions that Dan will answer. Dan and I actually work together in government. He may not be able to admit it anymore, actually preceded me at DHS. He was part of the Ridge team before the Chertoff team came in. I was in the Chertoff team. And it is a testament to his commitment that he's still there and still enthusiastic about what he does. So let me just ask you for some history from somebody who's been at policymaking levels all that time. How has DHS changed? Is it a grown-up department now?
Well, I was there April 2003, right at the beginning, and left about 4 years ago, 2009. And came back recently, so I have that perspective of coming back and seeing it. And I have a lot of like cultural kind of reactions all the time. Like I think about you often. 6 o'clock in the morning, I get on this elliptical machine, and the NAC gym is the first place I met you.
That's right.
I always think. Stuart, first time I ever saw him on this elliptical machine, the Washington Post spread out across the elliptical machine, off he goes, 6 o'clock in the morning, page to page to the, and I think it's still the same machine, to be honest with you.
Our
humble gym.
Well, we had to buy them all and pay for them out of, the REC, Morale and Welfare Fund, if I remember right.
So I'm now confident it is the same elliptical machine because we're not spending any more money. At the time, I was the Officer for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, as you know. Mm-hmm. I started in April 2003, the same day as the first Chief Privacy Officer started at Department of Homeland Security. I remember those first days she and I just got off, Newell O'Connor Kelly, who's now the president of the Center for Democracy and Technology. We got offices right beside each other and tried to make some hay in this department with this kind of portfolio we had of civil liberties protection. I remember the first time she said that there's something called a privacy impact assessment and we needed to kind of sell these around the department. I shrugged, you know, good for you, good luck, you know.
No, they're cranking them out.
Oh, they're cranking. Well, that's the thing that struck me as I came back. Even the first week I was there, I stumbled across somebody in a cubicle and I looked at it and it said so-and-so privacy office. And somebody, the undersecretary, right beside her office is the chief privacy officer for NPPD. There were people all over. And then I started to look at the website. There are, I don't know, 8, 10, maybe 12 privacy impact assessments, published privacy impact assessments. Right. So this is just one place of NPPD, not the rest of the department.
I would, for the associates, the law firm associates who listen to this, here's a research tool. If you want to understand a program at DHS, look first to see if there's a PIA on that program. It explains the whole program in words of one syllable and then down to very granular details about how it works, much better than like the statement of routine use or whatever statements about how these things are used, which are quite uncommunicative. These things are actually written in English for ordinary readers.
Well, I've been struck being back at how that idea of civil liberties protection, remember we always talked about it, and how institutionalized it's become there at a strategic level, which is really the level when you and I were there, was much more there. And then now really at an operational level, where a lot of con ops have some of these concepts built in, and now even in U.S. CERT and other places at a tactical level, where these guys are doing analytics are trained in privacy protection and how to deal with PII and emails are coming. And so at all three levels, so that's one of the things I've really been struck by is the things that we tried to do at the beginning, these 10, 12, 15 years later, are starting to, I mean, you know, making it real daily difference. So that's one thing that stood out to me.
And how well organized and well integrated does the department seem? And certainly, I would have said it was organized, or it's integrated, wherever the secretary paid attention and not integrated if the secretary or the deputy secretary wasn't paying attention. So the integration occurred under the spotlight, but only under the spotlight. Do you think that's still true?
Well, I feel like it's a more mature place coming back to it. It's, for better and for worse. I mean, it's got processes. And there's something that's supposed to happen. There's a person who go to an office, and it's their job. And it wasn't always like that when you and I were there, which was the fun of it, to be honest. Yes. It was entrepreneurial. Our environment, NPPD, has that feel of the early days because we're still figuring it out. And you can, if somebody has a good idea, we can go do something new. Let's do that. Let's pursue that. So it has that feel. But one on the integration, I don't know, I'll mention to you is cybersecurity is obviously a multidisciplinary, complex project. All across the Department of Homeland Security, there are significant pieces of the cybersecurity puzzle. So, every Wednesday, we have a sync meeting, Cyber Wednesday. And everybody in the department, all the way around, you know, everyone that comes, comes and sits and we talk for whatever length of time it takes, and you would be shocked at, as a former government people, at how long we'll invest there. But that syncing, that integration is so important, that the people invest the time on that on a Wednesday morning to just go around the room and everyone share what their piece is, from the CIO, Coast Guard, you know, TSA, all the way around the room.
So, and you've mostly got your leadership in place now, all right? Suzanne Spaulding is running the NPPD, and she's got, what, two deputy unders?
There are two deputy undersecretaries. The more notable one in this regard is Dr. Phyllis Schneck, who you have talked about here on the podcast before, but she's the deputy undersecretary for cyber.
Phyllis's sister used to work here.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And she worked with me on cybersecurity. It's it runs in the family.
Well, she was the chief technology officer at McAfee. She's making a huge contribution to us because I hear the sentence, you know, three times a week. In a boardroom, here's how we would receive that.
Yes.
And that's really important for us to hear and understand. So, she's been on board about 6 months. Just in the last week or two, we have the new assistant secretary for cyber and communications, Dr. Andy Osmond.
Oh yeah, sure. From the White House.
From the White House, right? So he's done cyber from the White House level for a number of years, and it's a real coup for us to be able to get him, and it's been seamless for him to come in and hit the ground running. And then he has two deputy assistant secretaries. One has been in that role for a while, Bobby Stempfli. She's the assistant secretary for cyber. She's really going to focus on strategy, policy, and the telecommunications issues, which is really her strong suit. And then also last week, Brigadier General Greg Tuhill just started as a deputy assistant secretary. He's going to focus on operational issues, Einstein, CDM, some of those
enormous multi-hundred million dollar programs that DHS has picked up in the last 4 or 5 years.
Right.
Those are a big deal, they can't, you know, the department can't boot those, and it has to hire smart people to run them, but then they can also use those smart people for policy input, which is critical. This is why NSA is as good as it is. It's because it can't fail at certain missions, and it has to hire people and give them a challenging job and a lot of leeway, and then it can free ride on that talent for other capabilities as well. So this will enable DHS to provide a little bit more of a counterweight to NSA in the at the engineering level.
Right. Well, General Tuhill, I think, he just retired from the Air Force, started with us He was the CIO of Transcoms, very experienced in these major acquisitions. So it's a very strong team, and as I said, just those major last pieces just in place in the last couple of weeks.
So to take this back to the interagency and the private sector, we've got a NIST cybersecurity framework. The president's executive order said after I get that, actually before I get it, about the same time, I want to hear from all the regulatory agencies about whether they can incorporate this framework into their regulatory mandates, and I want DHS to ride herd on those agencies as they coordinate the implementation of the incentives and the program generally. What's actually happening? It's been 3 or 4 months right. since the framework came out, and I've heard speculation that it'll take a year for the regulatory agencies to actually decide what they're going to do here, but I wondered what you can tell us about that process.
Well, just to give people a little background, Section 10 of the executive order is what you're referencing. It requires the variety of agencies to look now at the framework, when the framework would be issued, to look at their regulatory regimes and try to determine if something needs to be adjusted or new regulations need to be enacted to encourage adoption of the framework. That's comes out of Section 10. The I'll say this over and over, or if you talk to others from DHS, I think you'll hear this from us. The key really is promoting or stimulating or catalyzing voluntary activity. So regulatory authority should complement or support voluntary activity. That's the environment really that we're operating in. So the idea behind Section 10 is for agencies to figure out ways that they can adjust their regulatory regime to encourage voluntary activity. You know, I think at this time, I know within our department, there's been a lot of innovative thinking, people thinking outside the box on some approaches maybe we've adopted in other areas. Agencies are starting to file those reports with the president, but as you said, it's going to take a little while to sort through it. I think you both have been in government and you're familiar with that it takes a little bit of time to work through regulations.
Oh, yeah. And
some
regulatory
years
authority, and sometimes, I mean, I'm sure the FTC said, oh, yeah, we got authority to do that because we got authority to do anything we want. for people who feel a little more legally constrained, it's actually tricky to decide whether you have authority to move from regulating the safety of pipelines to regulating their cybersecurity.
Right. I think, too, any new approach somebody decides to take or has an idea to take in the regulatory environment, you need to circulate, you know, socialize that with the interagency, then OMB, then you start working through that whole process, which can take, you know, even some years to work through.
Yeah.
So of all the years in the executive order, I think that is the area that maybe you would not, outside government, start to see impacts of, you know, the quickest.
So I thought the president said, I want a report from all of you about whether you need new legislation, or whether you can do stuff on your own. And that was a deadline for that, which was approximately February of this year. And so there should be a process by which that is turned into legislative proposals, though, you know, nobody is expecting legislation to pass anytime soon. But I would have thought that the interagency process was chewing away on this.
Oh, there's a lot of good thinking going on. I just can't report something back to you because it's an interagency process that's, you know, chewing it all over.
It's going to last 14 years.
Right. Well, hopefully it's not. Hopefully it's not. But again, the key is for us is to encourage voluntary action. There's so much that can be done in our current authorities, and we're already doing. We've got a program under the executive order. The voluntary program is supposed to, there's the framework, and then the next piece is the voluntary program. We're calling it the C-Cube voluntary program.
What is that going to amount to? What kinds of voluntary incentives can have you decided you can use?
Well, a lot of this is public, and it's been fascinating. There's one of the elements of the executive order required our economists and other to do a report on incentives, where it was a little bit of brainstorming. It wasn't necessarily what could be done today, but in terms of grant programs or other things like that, and that's published, and it's on the website.
This is the thing where the Commerce Department did their study.
Right,
and
exactly. Treasury, DHS did one, and then Michael Daniels blogged about it, about some of the incentives that you can read on the White House website. So that's prospective and thought-provoking.
I have to say, I think when I give a speech, I
describe that, and then I put up a picture of the Tooth Fairy and say, you know, if you believe in the Tooth Fairy, you can believe in grants and tax breaks for cybersecurity. But in the world we live in, that they don't look particularly plausible.
Well, there's, but then we do have the C-Cube voluntary program, which is really kicked off in February, the year anniversary of the executive order, and that comes with it. That program comes with a lot of tools. I was just on a call with a company discussing this, and our person was laying out, here are the tools that we could avail. And the whole conversation went from, how can we get use of those tools? I'm going to get my person on the phone with you to try and talk about some of those.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I'll give you a few. Some of them are assessment tools that they use. They call it Cyber Resilience Review. Mm-hmm. And it's a way for a company to determine where are they in terms of cybersecurity. It's a tool that could be given to them, and they could use it themselves to figure it out themselves. Or a DHS team could go and help them work that
through. And it's tied, I assume, to the framework.
And it's tied to the framework. Everything now is tied to the framework as a common the value of the framework, it seems to me, is it's a common lexicon. So, you right. know, we know how to talk about these issues, and then it's also a set of best practices and a methodology you can use. So everything we're doing is tied to the framework and promotion of the framework. So anyway, the Cyber Resilience Review is one example of a tool that's being offered to companies.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's no particular cost to DHS. You didn't need new statutory authority to do it or new regulatory authority. It's a tool that we've offered. It's an interesting way to do government, I think, to how can we help you? What are ways we can help you to do the job you want to do?
Right. And if you've got somebody who wants to be helped, who wants to actually improve their cybersecurity, this works pretty well. If somebody is... You know, I think it was Oliver Wendell Holmes said that the best way to understand the law is to look at it through the eyes of a bad man, who only wants to do the things he has to do. And in that context, it strikes me that your statement that, well, we're looking for ways that we can encourage cybersecurity, and that's a little like net neutrality. You can say, we don't want you to discourage people from delivering stuff, but you can encourage people by giving special treatment to certain kinds of communications that need to get through. But at the end of the day, if you encourage enough people, you are discouraging the rest. And so any advantages that you give for good cybersecurity can just as easily be viewed as disadvantages for not having good cybersecurity. And it seems to me that the use of the framework in the context of litigation is going to be one of those. You could say, well, the good news is if you follow the framework, it's a standard and you will look more like a reasonable man to the courts. The bad news is if you can't show that your cybersecurity follows the framework, the courts are a whole lot less likely to find you have acted reasonably. Is DHS going to play a role in thinking about the litigation consequences of the framework?
Well, the broader point is incentivizing.
Yep.
And incentives can come from a lot of different quarters. It can come from industry associations. For example, the American Chemistry Council just issued their, I think they call it reasonable care. It's an industry set of standards on that they put out for a number of years, but it has Safety Act certification. And they've included cybersecurity as a part of the reasonable care program that they've put out. So you could get it from industry standards, and I'm sure other industries, that's just one that I'm mentioning. So you get it from industry. You get it, you said, from litigation. Courts could play a significant role here. You could get it from insurance. Right. Insurance, there is some insurance market there, I guess. But as a framework, maybe gives a lexicon there for insurance companies to begin to understand how to develop that. So in that context, DHS has held several forums as a convening power, using government's right. convening power, to think about the insurance issue.
This is what I call the tea and cookies of the power of government. You just bring them in and offer them tea and cookies, mm-hmm. and maybe they'll come.
And it's significant. I think you get people around the table who haven't thought about issues that way before, and there's been some benefit to it.
It does seem to me that when if somebody used your assessment tool and decided that they were doing it right and then got sued because of a breach, it would be not implausible for them to say, well, I was
adhering to the standard, and since I was using the DHS tool, we know that I was here adhering to the standard the way it should be adhered to, and it's not up to somebody to say I should have done it slightly differently because I was following guidance from DHS.
Makes sense.
You know, when we were hoping, I think the administration was hoping to get legislation as opposed to voluntary executive order. The conventional wisdom was that the principal advantage of a statute over an executive order was that the statute could actually provide these incentives like liability limitation, safe harbor from lawsuits. And the principal weakness of not having a bill, I think, is that, although the irony is, in the meantime, the litigation environment has become so aggressive against breach victims that, you know, while you won't have the safe harbor from getting sued that a bill would have provided, the fear of getting sued, or really the certainty of getting sued, is going to provide sort of a negative incentive. And I think what you just described, Stuart, is going to happen. It's not, you know, companies aren't going to be able to avoid getting sued, but they're more likely to prevail if they can point to the fact that they've adopted or at least considered adopting the framework or used some of the tools that you're talking about to assess their own weaknesses and taken measures to address them. I think people are going to be waving the framework around when they're sued. They just unfortunately can't avoid being sued in the first place.
So we can look forward soon to the FTC putting out guidance that says just because you follow DHS's guidance or the cybersecurity framework doesn't mean that if you cause harm to consumers, we can't hold you in violation of our unfairness authority. let me close with one question, because I'm not going to ask you to react to that.
Thank you.
Safety Act, you mentioned it. The American Chemistry Council sort of jammed it into their existing Safety Act program, which is fine, except that the Safety Act is really aimed at terrorist acts. So that if there is a terrorist act, you get quite a bit of protection if you've been through the Safety Act. There's legislation coming out of the House Homeland Security Committee that I was kind of struck by because it seemed to have reasonable bipartisan support that would authorize an expansion of the Safety Act to cover cybersecurity plans. Do you have any idea what, one, the administration's position on that is, and two, what the prospects are for the legislation?
We have, in my neighborhood, we have a little ice cream truck that drives around, and all the kids come running when the bell rings. I mean, this is old style. And I'm a little bit like one of the kids who runs to the ice cream truck but doesn't have any money to buy the ice cream, so I have to watch all the other kids eat the ice cream. And this is one of those areas, just brainstorming about a very interesting policy proposal that you can do very effectively, right, but I, sitting where I am, can't do particularly well. So I can't eat the ice cream very well here, but
it is so good.
It is a really interesting idea. We've talked about it a lot, about, as you know, the Safety Act, as you said, is in the context of counterterrorism. So how do you take that concept and apply it in cyber? Defining, for the Secretary to define a terrorism incident is probably a whole lot easier than to define a cyber incident, which one of these, you know, 5,000 incidents you want to describe as a cyber incident. So it is an interesting idea. I know there's a lot of discussion about how to make the
administration hasn't taken
a position on it. I think it's still early days on it.
I guess that's right. So it came up through the House, they didn't necessarily care what the administration thought. When it gets to the Senate, they'll undoubtedly, you guys will be called as witnesses. You'll have to answer at that point.
But I do want to say on the legislative front, there's a lot of thinking going on. It doesn't. Just because the legislation you referenced earlier, the legislation didn't pass, doesn't mean that it isn't still seen as a really important issue. A lot of key senators and key staffers were discussing things all the time. It's a live environment, and that's one example of an idea that people are discussing and trying to think, where do we go from here, and how do you craft legislation if it needs to be.
All right. Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming today. I have to say, despite starting before me and coming back to DHS, you really look remarkably healthy and well-rested. So that's a change in the atmosphere of DHS.
You look younger than both of us, so it must be a low-stress job.
All right. One last
question, and we'll give Dan a chance to answer it, and then I'll ask Jason and Maury. New feature. Any things you want to plug? Speeches you're going to be giving? Articles you have coming out? Oral arguments that you're going to be making? Something that the listeners might be interested in actually catching up with you in person?
Oh, I didn't realize you're starting with me. Next Wednesday, I'll be on a panel on data breaches at the Dow Jones Compliance Symposium here in D.C. And the following Wednesday, April 30th, I'll be speaking in Boston at the SAN Security Leadership Summit. And actually have an article coming out, finishing up today, so hopefully within the next week or two, on an issue that we talked about on the podcast a week or two ago, the issue of judges trying to put constraints on the scope of search warrants for computers and email accounts.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm sure that your remarks on the podcast will come back to haunt you, at least in front of those magistrates. Maury, anything you'd like to tell us about?
Well, not in information security, but one of the reasons I'm an advisor to Steptoe now rather than a partner is I wanted to do a few other things, and I'm publishing a novel this week about a deal between the U.S. and China. It's called The Deal, it's a good book and should be available on Amazon in about 10 days, so I would encourage people to read it.
So is this a Kindle? This will be available on Kindle?
It'll be available on Kindle, yeah, within 2 or 3 weeks. Physical book probably within about 10 days.
And is this self-published or did you find a publisher?
It's sort of halfway. It's self-published through an organization called Completely Novel in the UK but they're giving me a launch event and introductions to agents and things like that. So I'm hopeful it'll get some attention.
Maury Schenck, The Deal.
Not Maury Schenck, The Deal. I'm keeping my identities separate. I should have mentioned that. It's David Zen, The Deal.
Zen, Z-E-N?
Yes.
Okay. Or I guess I should say Z-E-N now that you're in Britain. All right. David Zen, The Deal. We will all be downloading it with enthusiasm. Dan, anything you want to plug?
I don't think I can top that. I don't have a novel, but I don't have anything particular. We're doing a number of brainstorming ideas with the National Security section at the ABA, so I think we'll have some programs over the summer, and I think maybe as we do, I'll shoot you a note and you can mention them, or you'll be participating in them yourself.
Okay, I'll be glad to. I have May 2nd, Association of Foreign Intelligence Officers is having an intelligence symposium, and I'm running a panel with a number of exalted eminences about NSA. So that's my schedule. Let me just conclude by thanking the participants in the podcast. This has been episode 15 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Jason Weinstein, Dan Sutherland, and Maury Schenck for joining us. Please come back next week for more insights into the latest in technology, security, privacy, and government. Thank you.